Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'm Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida. Welcome to Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to begin by thanking everyone who has joined us tonight for the recording of Tuesday Topics. And, of course, would like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities, whose software makes things happen here in the politics room. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're going to be exploring the disability rights movement in terms of where it is and what some of the issues might be. And we're actually going to be talking in particular with Larry Wanger, who is an individual who does a disability radio program that I'm sure he will tell us some more about. But before we get to the program, Larry, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and where you live and what you do and how you got intrigued by the disability movement, if you like.
Sure, Paul. Thanks for the opportunity to be on the show. I'm Larry, and I live out in Phoenix, Arizona. I've lived here for a little over 2 years now, and previous to that, lived in Michigan, and I certainly like Phoenix most of the time a lot better, except for a few months in the summer there. But we survive. I have had a visual impairment for my entire life, and my eyesight is, you know, much worse than it used to be. And so I've had a disability all of my life, and read Braille and use JAWS and those types of things, and have been a member of ACB for a couple of years now. I guess that I would say that my background is in disability rights and advocacy. I've worked now for nearing 10 years with two different centers for independent living, one up in Michigan and now out here in Arizona, here in Phoenix, and have been fortunate enough, or misfortunate, depending on the day you ask me, I guess, to have the opportunity to work in management and program development and that sort of thing. But my heart is really in advocacy, and I think in some part I do the show that I do, and I'll talk about that in it, to give myself that opportunity to talk about issues and be an advocate, because I just don't get to do enough of it at work anymore. I was kind of drawn to radio and doing show that I do now, Disability Nation, because I've worked in radio previous. So before I started working in the advocacy community, I worked about a year in radio at a small station up in Michigan and did the news and researched news stories, wrote editorials and some things like that, and really enjoyed that. But unfortunately, it didn't pay a lot, barely anything, and I pretty much realized that I was going to have to move on. So I did, and here I am today. So I'm certainly happy for this opportunity to talk about the disability rights movement and the disability community. I think there are a lot of issues that we certainly can talk about, and I hope everyone finds this to be a good conversation.
I'm going to ask you, if you would, help blind people understand what Centers for Independent Living are. I think we all know that they exist, but we perhaps don't know an awful lot about where they came from, what their philosophy is, and kind of what they do. Where do they fit into the disability services scheme of things?
That's a great question, actually. And let me start by saying the perception, and things I've been told by a number of blind people, is that the perception in the blind community, and not for all, but I've been told this by some people, is that Centers for Independent Living are places for folks who use wheelchairs, and that they don't offer anything for blind persons. And I was told that on a couple of occasions when I worked at the center up in Michigan, and so I've really tried to work to correct that false assumption. But let me back up and say that Centers for Independent Living are meant to be community-based advocacy organizations. By community-based, I also mean consumer-based, in that there are certain requirements that centers have to be controlled, staffed, and operated people with significant disabilities, and that meaning all types of disabilities. So I'm going to forget the exact section of the law, but it's as part of the reauthorization of the Rehab Act, Centers for Independent Living were created and received federal funding that helps to cover some of their costs. Obviously, they're not completely federally funded organizations. In fact, the agency I work for, it's a very small part of the pie that makes up the funding of the organization, but they receive federal funding so long as they provide four types of services in their program. So as long as they provide peer support, advocacy, information and referral, and independent living skills training or independent living services, then an agency can be considered a Center for Independent Living, apply for federal recognition, federal funding, and those types of things. It's a pretty convoluted process, but that's the basis behind it. So when we talk about consumer controlled, part of the requirements in that Rehab Act authorization, it states that Centers for Independent Living must be staffed by at least 50% people with significant disabilities, and that their board must be made up of 50% or more people. Well, it's really 51 on both levels, 51% or more people with significant disabilities on the board level. And that's to ensure the philosophy of independent living, that that prevails within the organization, or at least one step that tries to ensure that. So there's about, my understanding, about 600 centers across the country. They provide varying amounts of services, types of services. Some just do advocacy. Some provide different services. But they are meant to provide services to all people cross disability. So anyone with a disability, no matter what their disability is. And just to say briefly back to my first comment, about the perception I get sometimes, and not all the time, but sometimes from the blind community, you know, again, that centers don't necessarily offer things for blind people. They can, and sometimes it's just people getting involved. To give an example, I know that everybody with disabilities uses public transportation at one time or another, or might, and that's an excellent opportunity for blind persons to get involved in advocacy with their center. And there's plenty of other things. I mean, so they're all about everyone with a disability, or at least supposed to be.
Now, Centers for Independent Living essentially were a relatively late arrival on the rehab scene. They kind of emerged out of the 1980s. And you alluded to, if you like, the philosophy of independent living. Maybe you could talk a bit about what that philosophy was, maybe who some of the leading proponents were, and what makes centers different from other service delivery agencies, at least in theory.
Well, actually, Paul, Centers for Independent Living and the philosophy actually began back in the 60s. They kind of became formalized and really took off in the early 80s across the country, but the roots of the movement are back in the 60s. You may have heard of Ed Roberts, and he was a student with a very significant disability, and I think he used an iron lung and some things like that. He attended school at UC Berkeley and had to ask for the right to actually attend school, and he lived in the infirmary, and just because the floors and construction and some of the buildings, dormitories and such, couldn't support the iron lung that he used. But he had to advocate for the right to actually go to school, and he had to actually advocate for other people with disabilities to have the right to go to college. And out of that was born this movement that medical professionals and rehab counselors back in the day, you know, might have felt a certain way about people with disabilities and the type of work that, you know, we could do as people with disabilities. But part of the independent living philosophy is that people with disabilities who've lived it, who have the experience, are actually sometimes, and really often is my experience, the better people to consult about what you may or may not be able to succeed in your life, and where to go and how to get help, and techniques for living, those types of things. So it grows out of that belief. We refer to kind of the traditional rehab model as sometimes as the medical model, or medically based, in that it's professionals telling people with disabilities where to go, when to eat, you know, if you have a significant disability and need someone to take care of you, stay in an institution sometimes, you know, all those types of things. So it's a big departure from that. And so centers kind of grew out of that philosophy. And it's, you know, the best way I can sum it up is just, it's a philosophy that says it's all about you as an individual with a disability determining what you want to do in your life and being as independent as possible, being a part of your community, and not being put in a position where you're dependent on or somehow controlled by a model that says when and what you will do.
Yeah, in a very real sense, I think that the independent living movement paralleled developments that were happening in the blindness consumer movement as well, though I suspect there are those in NFB who would probably question the validity of that argument. But I think that there are some core values that are very similar. a belief that really the society constitutes the chief barrier to the progress of people with disabilities, and it's the responsibility of people with disabilities to work together to try to eliminate some of the barriers that society has purposefully or by ignorance created for people with disabilities. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that, and that sometimes society does things by ignorance. Sometimes they just do it and don't want to be flexible, but I think you're right on the money there.
So it would seem that the independent living movement and consumer organizations of blind people, consumer organizations of deaf people, consumer organizations of wheelchair people, quadriplegics, and others ought to be a wonderful fit, that we ought to be working together to forward the interests of the disability rights movement and indeed the interests of disabled people in general. But I would say that that really hasn't happened. Consumer organizations of blind people in particular, I'll learn to speak, have not, for the most part, found themselves able to cooperate as closely as one might have expected with centers and with the independent living philosophy. Do you have some thoughts as to why that might be?
Let me say, though, that I don't think we're peculiar as a disability community and as a blind community in that respect. If you look around you at any other organization or group of organizations that claim to represent a group of people or a cause, I think you see some similar things. You see people who disagree about how things should be done. That, on the surface, is a good thing. I mean, it's kind of how ideas and the way forward is found, I think. And as I said, it's certainly the disability community is no exception to that, and the blindness community is no exception to that. However, I guess I would like to think that there are issues, and I have seen that there are issues that we're able to come together and work on as people with disabilities overall. And, you know, voting accessibility is a great example there. I don't think you could have found, well, I guess you could have, but in general, I don't think you could have found too many people with disabilities who would willfully stand up and say that you as an individual, no matter what your disability, you as an individual shouldn't have the right to an accessible private vote. I think we can all agree about that. Now, obviously, within the blindness community, as I've been told by folks from both organizations, there's differing opinions about when and how we should have accomplished that, but that's a whole nother discussion. We can agree on certain issues, but I think there are other issues. Accessible currency is a good and current one to take up that for some reason we just can't agree, you know, and we'll take the blindness community specifically. And this is one that I look at and say my perception is that that is actually causing damage, I think, in the world for some folks in terms of the view of blind people. People looking at us and saying, these guys can't even get on the same page. At least that's my perception, that it's just too bad that it's gone this way. And there's certainly been other issues that have had the same thing happen in the past for blind people, be it descriptive audio or, you know, descriptive video type stuff, those types of things where, you know, an audible cross signals and that kind of thing. So it's to be expected that we're going to disagree, and yet I would like to think that there are issues that we could put aside our differences and find common ground on and work on together. And I think there needs to be some open invitations to do that from different disability organizations. It would be nice if we find some issues to really give us some of that fundamental exercise to continue to build some of that coalition building, if you will, because the fact is that when you're organizing, the one thing that your opponent wants to do is divide you, and I think it's pretty easy to do that. And sometimes with the disability community, because we have our own needs and our own opinions, and sometimes people don't necessarily take the time to think about how other people might feel about issues or other disability groups might feel about issues. But, you know, so it's sometimes can be pretty easy to divide, you know, the coalition of people with disabilities. But I would certainly like to see more opportunity to work together.
I think that the American Council of the Blind has worked fairly hard to try to find places where we could work with the broader disability community in a much more meaningful way than the National Federation of the Blind has. NFB has generally felt like it needs to stick to blindness topics and that it isn't interested in coalitions. I know that when I was president of ACB, and even now, ACB is working pretty closely with NCD and CCD and other organizations of a broader disability orientation, the American Association of People with Disabilities as well, to try to create consensus among the disability community about some of the ways forward. And I think there are a lot of areas where in fact we are cooperating. I think that the thing that's made it most difficult for us to cooperate with the wider disability community has been some positions that have been taken by NICL, which is the National Council on Independent Living, very large and very powerful lobbying organization with an immense amount of influence, I think, within the disability community. Their view is, for whatever reason, they are not prepared to accept or value the idea of specialized services. That is, they believe that you can best provide services to people with disabilities through generalized agencies, whether they're centers for independent living or whether they are vocational rehabilitation. They've taken the position that that's the way to deliver services, and the blindness community has simply not been able to accept that. Would you want to try to provide a broader explanation for the cross-disability orientation that the independent living movement has taken?
You know, to be honest with you, it's tough for me to respond to the specifics about NICL's position on services and how they're provided to blind people, specifically if you want to talk about that aspect of it in terms of separate agencies, separate state agencies and that kind of thing. I am aware of their position. I guess I would just say that I think that perhaps their position is partly based in the idea that if you promote segregating services of people for people with disabilities, that that promotes that kind of thinking elsewhere, maybe. Again, it's just tough for me to really respond to that. Personally, I guess my feelings about it are that there's certainly some value, a lot of value, to providing specific services to blind person. Absolutely there are. And that, furthermore, I would like to see, and it's I do see it happening more and more, blind people helping to provide those services. And in fact, that goes back to at least part of the independent living philosophy that I accept and really like, people with disabilities helping to provide services and assistance to other folks with disabilities. So that's an aspect of, in fact, the rehab counselor that I worked with way back when, visually impaired herself, and I think there was a level of understanding that I could talk to that individual about issues at work or accessibility issues and actually be talking to someone that understood it. I think there's a lot of value in that. Now, does it need to be a completely separate state agency and those types of things? I don't know. That's a discussion of not just the philosophy, but economics and state budgets and that kind of thing. I don't necessarily think that, you know, and don't shoot me here because I know I'm on the, you know, talking to blind folks here, but I don't know that it's necessary that a whole separate state agency exists to provide services to blind people. Perhaps there's ways to integrate that more, but the actual reasons for it and philosophy and need to have those services presented in a certain way and some of the examples that I just talked about, I think are really important, and we cannot lose that. I don't know that NICL understands that or values that or not, to be honest. So I'll leave it at that, I guess.
I think part of the issue for NICL is that if you promote specialized services for one group, then every other group is going to want it. And what you end up doing is fragmenting service delivery and making the cost of delivering services to people who are disabled immensely higher. And I think their view is, as you suggest, that in a general agency, you actually probably can find enough people who will have enough individual training and specialized expertise to deliver appropriate and effective services to blind people. I don't think that there is enough understanding within the independent living movement about the special circumstances that operate for people who are blind, and I also think, to a degree, people who are deaf. And I think that that's partly the reason their position is the way it is. before we go any further, I really need to agree with you, Larry, that the independent living movement and the blindness movement have been able to work together very successfully to make a number of things happen. Accessible computing is a good example where we've worked together. Accessible voting is another good example where we've worked together. And I think that as well, there are issues relating to Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare where we've worked well. One of the preoccupations of the disability movement today is the Americans with Disabilities Act and the degree to which it's either a failure or isn't a failure. And the disability rights movement finds itself, I think, in an interesting position right now with regard to the ADA. From your perspective, where do you see the disability rights movement and the ADA at this point?
I like to think I actually bring an interesting and maybe different perspective than many people often hear. My experience is that many people who are involved with advocacy and the disability rights movement are older. Not old, but older than I. And we're around to work for passage of the ADA and some people even things before that. They know more than I even what was meant and what was wanted in putting the ADA in place. And where we're at now versus me, I graduated from high school the year that the ADA was passed and really had no concept of what it was. I look back now and when did I first hear about this ADA? You know, so that may be startling to some people. But so my perspective on it is looking at it from not somebody who worked to get it passed, but somebody who certainly has benefited from it as somebody who has in the past worked with two different guide dogs and had public access and somebody who appreciates things like Braille signage and demarcations at curb cuts that hopefully are starting to happen now and those types of things. So, I certainly have an appreciation for it for sure and the things that it has brought about. But I also have the good fortune of working as an advocate and trying to use the ADA to help people who were sincerely being treated badly or discriminated against, and primarily on the employment side, though I also look at accessibility and some of those things. And I tell you, it's really frustrating to look at it because my perception is that it was really meant to increase the opportunities for people with disabilities to work. And frankly, it has not done that at all. I mean, it's helped some people, but the unemployment rate overall is pretty much the same. So that wasn't the answer there. It's something else, and maybe that's what the ADA could accomplish. You know, you can't change attitudes with legislation, unfortunately. So, you know, that's a whole other discussion. But certainly with accessibility and things like that, you still see just egregious acts of discrimination. People, just this past week, I interviewed on my show Nancy Cave, who is a mother of a youngster who he's 14, who has a hearing impairment, and the school refuses to give him access for a service animal. Well, that's a given, you know, and yet they will not do it, and there's some extenuating circumstances there. I've helped people, and even myself, been a victim of employment discrimination, straight-out harassment and treatment that was just completely inappropriate because of the disability, and yet you cannot get enforcement or justice in any situation. It seems, you know, 90-some% of the cases that actually do make it to court, which is very few, then go in favor of the employer. So, you know, it's just really not working. And it's not working on a number of levels, though. You look at the definition of disability and what the ADA covers and doesn't cover, and Congress or the courts continue to narrow that, the Supreme Court and other courts continue to narrow that scope to the point that somebody who's disability corrected when they're on the job or whatever may not be covered under the ADA. And that's just not what was meant when that legislation was put in place, for sure. You can look at that and say that that's one reason the ADA isn't working. But I tell you another reason it's not working, it's enforcement. When it takes 2 years to get the Department of Justice to get through a complaint, 6 months to a year to acknowledge its existence, those types of things, and then, you know, the few that are taken on and you know, the fact that you can't get a lawyer to take on an ADA case that's dismissed from the EEOC or DOJ because there's no money in it in most cases. The enforcement and justice piece of it are also broken. So it's definitely in need of some improvement. And I don't want to belittle what it was meant to do and the good that it has done, because it definitely has done some really, really good things. But I don't think it's accomplishing what it was meant to. And that's an issue that I think all of us in the disability community should get behind. There's going to be legislation introduced that will change some of the language in the ADA, this ADA Restoration Act. I just last week read a call, an email calling for stories of discrimination or difficulty that people have had related to their disability in the ADA. So there's an effort to begin gathering some of that information and to make this happen. And when this bill is introduced, I hope that all 54 Americans or how many ever we really can say have disabilities will get behind it, because that's an opportunity.
And I think you meant to say 54 million Americans with disabilities get behind it. You said there were only 54 of us, and I suspect there are a few more than that. Do you think that the ADA is failing because of conscious efforts on the part of a conservative court system and a conservative administration to minimize its impact?
Well, in politics, and I think it goes as far as judges sometimes, it comes back to different reasons why people do different things and take different positions. But you look at some of the judges that are in place and some of the decisions they've made and statements they make and that kind of thing, and you have to wonder. And I don't really understand that, because it's been shown that in many cases, you know, accommodations don't cost a lot of money. Modifications, if they're done when construction is being done, isn't that costly? You know, those types of things. I don't know if there's a deliberate effort to minimize its impact and do some of those things, but you can sure draw that perception. And yet, I don't think that we should just say, oh, that, you know, the Democrats are in favor of our rights and the Republicans are opposed to it. I don't think it's that simple of an issue, but it sure has that appearance.
Yeah, I would concur that it isn't that simple. I think it's worth seeing that the ADA was signed when the first Bush was president, and that it probably would have been more difficult for a Democrat to get the ADA passed and signed, and that certainly there were an awful lot of Republicans who jumped on the bandwagon to make it happen prior to 1990. So I think it's important not to draw it entirely as a political party issue. One of the things that's been discussed a lot in the disability rights movement over the past several years is the New Freedom Initiative that was started by the current President Bush. Do you have thoughts on how well that's worked and whether it's accomplished a lot?
I think it was a dog and pony show. I don't know. I really have not seen a whole lot of good things come out of it. There's certainly been some grants and some funding to different things, but the biggest issues in the disability community that continue to be pushed for, I mean, there's a lot of big ones, but you can look at issues for folks that have long care issues and trying to get things changed so that people with significant disabilities, instead of being institutionalized or put in nursing homes, can get care at home. It's been shown it's cheaper. It's been shown it's more effective in many cases and healthier and better. You know, it comes down to cost a lot of times, and yet we, you know, I've kind of followed that, and we have not been successful with that. We've talked about some of the ADA and disability issues, and one minute Bush is promoting equality and more services and programs and assistance for people with disabilities, and the next minute he's pushing to have judges confirmed that would really like to see the ADA go away, it sure seems. And so you've got to wonder about that. And now, for some reason, we have the Bush administration under his watch, the Department of Justice, the Treasury, appealing this decision to make currency accessible for a lot of reasons that have been shown to be pretty much baloney. And so I look at this and I don't know. I don't see a lot that's come out of it that has really benefited us. And I'm sure there have been some things, but I'm looking at major issues and just what I see on the surface, and there just has not been what needs to happen.
One of the most fascinating groups for me in the disability rights movement at the moment is a group called ADAPT. And ADAPT is an interesting group because when they were originally formed, they were formed to create access to public transportation. And they were actually pretty successful at doing that. It certainly is accurate to say that they had an awful lot to say about the shape of the transit components of the ADA, perhaps even to the detriment of people who are blind, by the way. But that's another discussion, as you would say, Larry. But I think that ADAPT is interesting now in that they are working pretty hard on this whole issue of deinstitutionalizing particularly people with quadriplegia and other individuals with physical disabilities who, with some supports, can live pretty effectively within communities. There are some in the disability rights movement who feel that the approach of ADAPT is far out and inappropriate. Do you have feelings pro or con in terms of the approach that ADAPT is taking?
Well, civil disobedience has done a lot of great things in the history of the world, and so there will always be a place for that, and you know, that's what they engage in. I'm sorry, but they do a lot to put disability in the face of people who otherwise might not see it. So that's reason number one that I like what about ADAPT and what they do. I'm, in fact, kind of looking at going out there to their next action in D.C. at the end of April because I kind of want to experience what they're all about, you know, what's happening there. I absolutely do feel that what they're doing is valuable, and I'm not saying it's always the right approach because it's not, but there's certainly a place for everything and all approaches, and sometimes it takes just a handshake and an introduction and you saying to your senator or to your representative in the House or to the president if you get that opportunity or to your local city council person, hey, I'm a person with a disability and these are some issues, and they're receptive to it. And other times it takes 500 people showing up and taking over the lobby of the Capitol building, and good things might come out of that too. So, yeah, a bit radical, you bet, but things get done that way, and you can look back in history at some other things that have happened because of similar philosophy and styles and say that it might not have happened otherwise. So I do like ADAPT. I do what they're about. But again, I think in any situation you have to evaluate who's involved and what it might take to accomplish what your goal is.
In general, I think I support ADAPT. They've certainly moved deinstitutionalization off the back burner to a place where it's actually a reality in some states, where money is actually being allocated for attendance for people who are quadriplegics and can live in the community. And it's certainly come a lot closer to becoming law. For those of you who are kind of following that debate, the laws we're talking about at the federal level are the MICASA laws, as they're often called. And I think ADAPT has done a fair amount of good. I was disappointed when I was president by their unwillingness to coalesce. I think there are a lot of issues where the ADAPT folks and blind folks, to take one example, could actually work pretty closely together. I tried to broker a deal with ADAPT that would have asked them to support the idea that we as blind people needed independent living services too, or community-based services like reading and, oh, perhaps help with transportation, and wanted to see whether they would join with us to broaden the base of the MICASA bills to include some of those components. And unfortunately, they absolutely rejected that idea, not because they necessarily disagreed with it, but because their view was that they had to stay focused on their particular issues, even if they recognized the value of expansion down the road. And so I think it's unfortunate, an example of what you were talking about earlier, where the disability rights movement can't seem to cooperate. Do you see any hopeful signs for the disability rights movement? Because there's certainly a lot of depression out there among those of us who are advocates in the disability rights movement. Do you see some hopeful signs?
Sure. I mean, One of the keys, though, I think, is getting young people to get involved and be advocates and be concerned about these issues. And we got to find a way to do that. I think that actually that's probably one of our biggest issues to be working on. I don't know too many people with disabilities my age. I encounter them, but I don't know too many who are involved. You know, I even work with people who who really aren't involved. They kind of do their job, but when you send them a piece about legislation that we really need to call our senator about and get behind or do something, well, I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, or don't bug me with it. And so we've got to get people that are younger to recognize that we got to get involved with this stuff. And I think that people who have been around for a while and been involved with advocacy and been working on this for a long time are good at this, but we've got to get younger people involved. And if we can do that and really kind of rally people and somehow get them involved more in the movement and what we're trying to accomplish, then I think there's certainly hope there. And I think there's hope because I like to think that more and more people are recognizing I don't want to say the value of people with disabilities because that just sounds kind of ignorant, but you know, that we're part of society too, and that we have a lot to offer, that we're, you know, that the misconceptions that people have just aren't true. And I think that's a big battle too, but yeah, there's a lot to be done, but there's reason to be hopeful and could be worse. That's not much consolation.
I'm going to ask one more question, then we're going to open it up for other people who may have some comments or questions for Larry. And I'm going to go back to Centers for Independent Living. There is a huge debate raging at present over what the appropriate agency is to deliver services to people with disabilities. Is it one-stops? Is it independent living centers? Or is it the traditional rehab system? Right now, we have all three of these entities often trying to deliver the same services to the same population. And there's a feeling that somehow over the next decade or two, that's going to have to change and we're going to have to see some go away. Do you have a strong sense about what direction you'd like to see, which is the most appropriate service delivery model and what should we do to promote it?
Well, that's a tough, loaded question for one reason, because I actually, at the center I work at, I'm the operations manager for our employment programs. And so all I do all day is work with folks with all kinds of disabilities who are looking for work and helping them find work. And I kind of manage those programs. So I fully understand. And believe me, it's frustrating for the consumer, too, the person with a disability who's out there trying to figure out where to go get services and who's going to do best for them. But you know what? I like that. I really like the fact that there's a lot of different service providers out there, and the cream will rise to the top. How's that? To be honest, on a personal level, when funding for the rehab system and devoting it over to, I think this was a couple of years ago, there was talk of moving that funding from the rehab system over to one-stops. And yes, I definitely had concerns about it, but I was really frustrated to see all of the disability groups seem to run to, or many of them, to the aid of rehabs, you know, the vocational rehab system, and, oh, don't cut the funding. And then it just kind of went away. And don't cut the funding, but let's work for better services and for trying to bring about improvements in outcomes. Because when you start talking about outcomes and actual, not just numbers of people worked with and those types of things, but actual outcomes of helping people with blindness or other disabilities to achieve self-sufficiency, getting off of Social Security and those types of things, I think when you start talking in those terms, it brings into question sometimes the quality of services that are out there. And I'm not saying that what I do in the program that is at my center is perfect for sure, but I think I think that we've got to start talking in those terms, make that the grading scale for our rehab services or the one-stops or anybody else. And we need to reward programs wherever they're at that achieve good outcomes of helping people to become self-sufficient and leaving Social Security because, gosh darn it, that's a good thing. You don't have to live in poverty and being successful. That's what I would like to see the rehab system of the future look like. And frankly, I mean, in the end, if it's achieving that and people are happy and we're reaching those outcomes, then I don't necessarily care who's providing the services. As long as they're making those outcomes, as long as people with disabilities are involved in the provision of those services so that connection with reality, if you will, isn't lost, the reality of what we with disabilities experience, that is, and as long as those things are part of it, whoever can provide it, let's do it.
I'm pretty sympathetic with the position that you take, I think. As, frankly, based on its white paper as ACB, I think that the American Council of the Blind's position is essentially that rehabilitation, despite having a virtual monopoly for an awfully long time, hasn't been able to get its act together and do the kind of credible and appropriate job that it ought to be doing at this point, given the head start it has. But I think what I heard you saying, and that I would absolutely concur with, is none of the service delivery models at this point are doing a good enough job, and we're, as a disability rights movement, not doing a good enough job in demanding that the kind of measures you're talking about become core values at the federal level in terms of evaluating the effectiveness of programs. We need to truly look at programs that are successful. It's one of the reasons why I've been an advocate for pushing some of the programs of National Industries for the Blind, because I think they are making an effort to develop some innovative approaches to employment, and those innovative approaches have often been successful and are in fact earning people at the lower end of the blindness spectrum some pretty effective kinds of salaries and benefits, even though they're delivering those in what's described as a sheltered environment. Let me see if you have a final thought before we open it up for some other questions, Lair.
Well, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to talk. I wasn't prepared, and yet I think we've had a good discussion. I absolutely agree with you with what you just said about National Industries for the Blind. I don't think it matters who is providing the services as long as they're helping people achieve good outcomes. You know, from a broader perspective, I think the number one thing that we with disabilities, no matter what our disability, is the responsibility that we have to ourselves, to other people with disabilities, and really to society, is to be involved in advocacy or just demonstrating an independent life and as independent as possible, and promoting self-sufficiency and the idea that people with disabilities can and should work, that we want equal rights and access and those types of things. It's really important, and sometimes I know it can get to be kind of old. We're always beating the same drum and that kind of thing, but we've got to do it. Nobody else is going to.
Let's open it up, see if people have some questions or some comments or some issues that they'd like to see Larry and I discuss some more, or some issues that you'd like to bring up that we haven't talked about at all.
Larry, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. It sounds like the rehab system today is more consumer-oriented than it was back 30 years ago when it was more like, we know what's best for you, or something like that. But there's been some controversy about whether blind people or partially sighted should teach mobility. What do you think about blind people or partially sighted people teaching mobility?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that relates to some of the other things about some of the steps that other organizations would promote that blind people should do in learning mobility and independent living and that kind of thing. I mean, when you started talking about your question, my mind wandered to that too. You know, I absolutely think that someone who's visually impaired or blind would actually bring some very good qualities to somebody who might be newly blind, getting, for example, orientation mobility skills. You as a blind person might be able to tell me, who just lost my sight, things I need to be listening for, little cues that you use to know when to cross the street, or you know that you've gotten to the other side of the room and you listen for how sounds sound, and just different things like that. When I go about explaining things to people, if a blind person asks me for directions, I just know how to give those directions. I'm not an expert at it, but I know what I would want to know. that as I truck along here with my cane, I got to watch out because I'm going to hit four trash cans and a light post, and some of those things. So really, from a practical perspective, I think that a blind person could bring some really good things to that rehab. I've already taught out some other aspects of rehab services and what I think, but specifically to mobility. I know that one of the guide dog schools is really experimenting with what kind of a role a blind person person could play as an instructor and being involved in that process. And I'm really intrigued to find out how that goes. Maybe they've already figured it out. I don't know. It's been going on for a while. But, you know, myself, though, and I don't mind talking too, because, again, my mind wandered to it when you asked your question about I have some usable vision, though it's getting less and less and really not much now. But I find that I really have to work. I'm not working a guide dog now, but and I'm using a cane. But I find as someone with usable vision that I actually benefit from using a blindfold in my mobility training and think it's a great technique to use to really force yourself to use your O&M skills or trust a guide dog and that kind of thing. Should it be required of somebody in any setting? Absolutely not. I don't think so. I think that's a personal decision. But my mind wandered to that as you asked your question, so I'll just throw that out there for the fun of it too.
Larry, one of the issues that you talked about earlier was our failure or the apparent failure to engage young people in disability activist roles. Do you have some thoughts as to why we haven't been able to do that?
I guess a couple things come to mind. One of those is that part of the philosophy or what we're pushing for as people with disabilities is the right and ability to live an independent life as part of a community and to be part of society. And maybe for some people it's that they don't necessarily need to go off and in a corner and be part of a disability organization. I don't know. That just came to mind. But so maybe in trying to promote that way of living and what we want in life, we've kind of accomplished that maybe in some respects. But a more realistic answer is that we're not unique as a community. I've read research that seems to indicate that college kids are pretty mindful about activism and things like that, but people then, and I'm talking about, you know, really society as a whole, at least in the U.S., then we kind of live our life and have our families and professional life and do those things. And then when we're older, we tend to become more community-minded again and issue-oriented sometimes. And these are generalizations, obviously. So maybe we need to realize that we're not that much different than other groups. I mean, every group that I've ever been a part of has always had one of their major issues, kind of the big thing that they need to worry about is maintaining themselves and having members who are younger involved. I've been in the Lions Club, and it's the same kind of thing. You know, I wouldn't dare to venture a guess as to the average age of the typical Lions Club member, you know, and other groups, unless they're specifically designed for and targeted at younger people. I think you find across the board that organizations, issue-oriented organizations or whatever, have members that are generally older, middle age or older, and that younger people might not be as involved with those groups. So we're not necessarily atypical. It's just that perhaps we've got some bigger losses to face if we can't engage those people.
Hi, Larry. This is Cheryl from Miami. Two things. One is, I wonder if the reason concerning what you're just talking about, the young people being involved versus the old, is the simple fact that when you're young, you haven't gone the miles. You haven't faced all of the opposing things that are out there. You're only beginning the race when you're older. You've run down the track a few more laps, and you've experienced something to really understand what you have to wrestle with as opposed to before, just starting out. And I think there's a lot of idealism when we're young. We are ready to conquer the world, and we don't see things as formidable as they can't be when we start out. So going back to the race analogy, you know, the longer you run, you get a little bit more winded, so things become a little more challenging. My question for you is perhaps you could clarify for me when you said it didn't really matter where people got their help from as long as they got the help they needed. My concern with that is because sure you can come out with good skills from someplace, but how many of us in this room can raise our hands and know that you can come out with some philosophy that accommodate your skills that can really mess you up? And I know personally I've had that experience and went through some training and came out with some skills, but I had to take several years to undo the philosophy that was taught me where I acquired those skills. And I think that's a huge issue.
Well, let me respond to your first point first. When I look back to reasons why I'm involved with advocacy and the disability rights movement, it's because some stuff happened when I was younger, going to school and the battle I had to, actually that my mom fought. And I kind of observed and learned from a true pro. But I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but, you know, back to that kick them in the head and have to go a few laps before you realize, hey, we've got some problems here. I just distinctly remember at some point in high school, an instructor that I had for no good reason at all said that because I was using Braille, and it wasn't writing Braille, it was just reading Braille. It was interesting. I could read, I couldn't read print unless it was really big, and it then took me time anyway. So I would read Braille, and then kind of, it was a multiple choice thing, and I might write my answer because I could see to write if I wrote in big print. It's all convoluted. But at any rate, I just remember being told that, well, Larry, you're using Braille, so you need to go take your exam elsewhere. There was no grounds for it, no reason, but I wasn't permitted to sit in the class with my other classmates and take this exam just because I was using a different format. And it's not like the students were going to read my paper, you know. So, and there were other things. I mean, just, you know, not being able to participate in some activities and that kind of thing. And so, looking back, I know that those are reasons, and I didn't fully understand their implications and that sort of thing at the time, but now I look back and say, you know, these things should not have happened, and I don't want to see these things happen to other people because it's pointless and senseless and whatever. So I don't. You're absolutely right, though, and I think a lot of us can look back and say, you know, I really didn't care that much, or wasn't, not even that I didn't care, I just wasn't involved with stuff until A, B, and C happened to me. So you're absolutely right. Related to your second and definitely important point about what I stated, I was definitely talking about rehab services and said certain elements of services that I would, you know, that we want to see people becoming independent, self-sufficient, independent of Social Security, that we want people with disabilities involved in the teaching and or receiving of rehabilitation services and that kind of thing. And maybe I didn't emphasize the philosophy well enough, but you are absolutely right on the money that that is an important thing that we need to consider too, and that needs to be part of it. You could have the best program in the world, but if you're kind of, you know, and achieve the best outcomes, but if you're putting minutiae into the heads of people and giving them philosophy that really is doing them more harm than good, then, you know, you're really not where you need to be.
I guess that in terms of the younger people issue, which we've kind of been talking about some, I think you're right on the money, but perhaps haven't emphasized it enough. I think it's getting an awful lot harder to recruit younger people nowadays because, as you suggested, we in the disability rights movement, in fact, have done a pretty good job of creating a society where it's actually relatively easy for a person with disabilities to be fairly fully engaged within the society itself. And I think an awful lot of the younger people with disabilities are essentially running 50 miles to stay away from other folks with disabilities because their intent is to try to pretend that, in fact, they don't have issues, that they're perfectly normal and perfectly capable. I think that what Cheryl was suggesting about only discovering how much they need disability rights when things happen is probably the way that many of those people are going to come back to the disability rights movement. But I really think we, all of us, whether we're talking about the independent living movement or whether we're talking about vision loss, have a huge problem in that most people who are young have no desire to identify themselves with the disability community. And I think until and unless we can create more of that desire, we're not going to get anywhere.
Paul, you're absolutely right. And I can say that from personal experience, that I did everything I could to be included in society, to be with my non-disabled peers through college and my, you know, young professional life and that kind of thing. And I suspect that if I did not work in the disability field, that I certainly wouldn't have the awareness of things that I do, and who knows? Yeah, maybe I wouldn't be very involved. But yeah, you're right. For the longest time, I knew about the ACB. I knew about the organization and what it was all about. I was fiercely independent, and still am, but I've recognized the need and value to be involved. And
we recently saw a change in the composition of the House of Representatives and the Senate in the November elections. Do you see that change as being a good thing for people with disabilities or not?
I think that things like this ADA Restoration Act probably, I won't say for sure, but probably stand a better chance of being implemented. Whether they get signed by the Prez, I don't know, but I think we stand some better opportunity to get something like that through. The ADAPT folks and others concerned about it, as I am, so it doesn't matter what party's in power. We really cannot just say that this party's better than the other party or expect that we're going to be more successful in our endeavors because a certain party's in control. We have got to stay at the wheel. And there are a lot of issues that are out there right now that we just need to stay on top of. We need to be involved and active. And maybe as blind people, we were told not this time around by ADAPT, or this group is not mindful of what we need. But we could also say, well, okay, and we'll still help you get this through in hopes that you recognize that we feel this is important. It's got to be a give and take kind of thing. Just to answer your question, yeah, I think that we're in better shape because there's a Democratic majority, but don't kid yourself and think that that means everything's going to be A-okay, because it may not be.
Larry, thanks very much for stepping in at the last minute and being an extremely informative guest on a topic that I think it's important for us to understand a lot more about than we currently do. People with disabilities are the largest single minority in the United States, but they don't exercise power that way. We are by far the poorest minority in the United States, but there's not much recognition that that's the case. We're certainly the most unemployed population in the United States, but the fact is that most people in American society perceive people with disabilities as folks who are, for the most part, being treated well by a system that looks after us. And until we can persuade that larger community not only to recognize that there are some pretty serious issues out there, but also to recognize that we as a group are a strong enough political force that we need to be taken seriously, I'm not sure that we're going to get anywhere. On behalf of Tuesday Topics, I'd like to thank Larry Wanger for being our guest. I'd like to thank those folks who were with us in the politics room tonight for their support and involvement. And I'd like to thank loyal listeners to Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio. Thank you very much for joining us on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.